The Guardian. Hello, and welcome back to A Rather Hungover Tech Weekly with me, Jemima Kish. On the show this week...
The key competitor to Wipelan is a customer sitting at home and watching telly or going around the corner to the same pub or the same restaurant where he or she has always been going to.
Rytus Witkauskas joins me to tell me why the art of spontaneity is at the heart of his Wipelan app. And...
E3 is such a mammoth show, but it also creates a window in the year where we can all kind of think about and get really excited about games and about what games do and where games can go.
Guardian games writer Keith Stewart joins me to preview the forthcoming E3 gaming convention. Also, we'll have a roundup of this week's technology news, including the growing popularity of encryption software in Turkey due to the riots, and why a landfill site in New Mexico is a goldmine for gamers. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. But first, the E3 convention in Los Angeles is a massive event for the computer games calendar. This year, with new consoles from both Sony and Microsoft tantalisingly close to release, expectations for the convention are high. To tell us if the hype is warranted or not, I'm joined by The Guardian's games writer, Keith Stewart. Welcome to the pod, Keith.
Hello, Jemima. Thanks so much. I hope your head is okay.
Yeah, I'm soldiering on. So, Keith, for the layman or somebody who doesn't know anything about E3, who goes, how many people go, and how significant is this event?
Okay, well, it's an enormous event for the video game industry. It's a trade-only event, so the public can't go, and it's essentially around 45,000 people. Most of them are developers, lots of press, a few fan sites and blogs about games managed to get in as well. It's kind of, I suppose the easiest way of thinking about it is kind of a cross between Glastonbury and Cannes, in that it's a big celebration of games culture, but it's also quite a big business event. But it actually lacks any of the glamour or sex appeal of both Cannes and Glastonbury. It's 45,000, mostly men, I would say, still at the moment, strolling around a very, very hot convention centre with enormous multi-million pound stands belting out really loud rock music and gunfire to lots of people in large queues eating awful food. But it's very
exciting. You're really selling it to me, Keith. Frankly, I'm glad that I don't have to go. Yep. But what's really going to be the big news here, and how do they break it? Is it all, you know, they save up their news and it's all embargoed news launches, or is it genuinely significant and meaningful?
It's tricky. It's ambiguous. If you are right within the games industry, if you're a hardcore fan, then this is very important. And this is a very important year for the games industry and a very important year for E3, because we have in one corner Microsoft with its new Xbox One console, and in the other corner we have Sony with PlayStation 4. Both of those consoles were announced previously to E3, but there's lots and lots of things we don't know about them yet. We don't know how much they're going to cost. We don't know the exact technical specifications. We don't know the exact date of when they're coming out, and we haven't seen a lot of games. So this is really going to be the first chance that lots and lots of gamers and, you know, the 4,000 media outlets that are going to be at E3 this year, this will be their first chance to get hands-on with some of the most significant games on both of these platforms. And, you know, this is a multi-million dollar investment from both of these companies. This is really going to set their next 5 years. If one of these consoles kind of falls at this first hurdle, this major unveiling, then it's going to be very difficult for them to get up, I think. So yeah, in a lot of ways, this is a really, really important focal point for the mainstream games industry this year.
Tell us why these new consoles are such an important moment for Sony and Microsoft, because we know that the Xbox One is making a pitch to be the main entertainment hub for your living room. Is that realistic?
It's complicated, and I'm not sure how realistic it is. The really interesting thing about the two machines this year is that actually technically, from what we do know about the technical specifications, they're very similar. They're both essentially reasonably powerful PCs. They're both multi-core processors, very powerful AMD graphics hardware. So technically they're the same, but yeah, the pitches are very different. Microsoft wants to see Xbox One as this all-in-one entertainment hub. It's going to be able to channel your cable television and allow you to swap easily between watching cable television and playing games. And it's also going to have Skype and a camera, so you'll be able to video chat with your friends. how realistic that proposition is depends very much on how smooth the interface is and how it works. A lot of people are wondering, well, if I already have a cable box, why do I need to then plug it through my Xbox in order just to be able to, say, use voice to control my Sky One subscription, for example? People are saying, well, I've got a remote control. I'm happy with that. Why do I need an extra, £300 box sitting in front of it? So it depends on how compelling Microsoft can make its case, which is going to rely on forging a lot of content deals with a lot of very different companies. And this is a very different battle for Microsoft. This isn't Microsoft versus Sony. This is becoming Microsoft versus Google, Microsoft versus Apple, Microsoft versus Virgin. There are lots of companies that are vying for this one box in your living room space. It's a totally uncharted war zone, really. And I think Microsoft isn't, I suspect, the strongest or even richest, maybe, player in this space. Sony's taken a very different approach. Sony's almost dropped out of that and said, we've learned from what we did with PlayStation 3. We tried to pitch PlayStation 3 as this all-in-one entertainment solution. The Blu-ray player that we put in was a very early Blu-ray player. It was hugely expensive. They lost a lot of money on hardware in the early days. They've said, sod this, we're going for games. And they have very much put games at the centre of their proposition this year. So, they haven't gone out and said, we want to dominate TV. They've said, we just really want to produce an excellent games machine. I think they're very much thinking, we'll sit behind that. We'll sit beside that cable box, thanks very much, and we'll do what we know very well.
Is it too simplistic to see those two as really competing neck and neck when actually they're going down different roads, aren't they? They're now pursuing their different propositions for consumers, is it?
Yeah, I think from the E3 context, they are still head and head, because at E3, all that matters is games. I think from a wider context, you could even argue that this is a head. Once upon a time, the console battle was a real head-to-head battle between two very, very dominant players in the games industry. So Nintendo versus Sega in the olden days was the Mega Drive versus the Super Famicom computer.
Oh, going back a bit.
I know, exactly. I mean, that was huge because those two dominated the industry. But now we play games on tablets, iPhones, we can play games on laptops. We're not so centered around the console ecosystem, if you like. So this is almost like a battle on the periphery now of the games industry, but it's still massively important because what happens with these consoles will filter across lots of different planes of the sort of consumer technology pipeline.
E3 then is massively important because it's the trade convention, but where do the cool kids go? Where do people who are interested in the creative side of gaming and those games releases, which conference are they going to?
Well, I think E3 is very large, and although it is dominated by big sequels, for example, things like Call of Duty Ghosts, Assassin's Creed 4, Battlefield 4, FIFA 14, these will be the big kind of tentpole things that their stands are built around. But if you investigate and get time to look around, you do find new things. Like, for example, on the PlayStation 4 stand, Jonathan Blow's indie game The Witness, which is a really interesting offbeat abstract puzzler, is going to be on the PlayStation 4 stand because it's an exclusive. That looks really, really interesting. But there's also an area of E3 called Indiecade, which is actually started out as a very separate festival based around small indie games. But now it has a space. It has actually a growing space within E3 where lots of small developers, lone coders, bedroom programmers can come along and show off their games. And there's some amazing games there. I mean, I think there's around 20 games showing off there. And they are so enormously different to anything else you'll find at the show. For example, there's a beautiful adventure game called That Dragon Cancer. And it's a kind of really heartbreaking interactive fiction with two parents coming to terms with their child's terminal cancer, which is not something you'd ever think you'd see at E3, but it's a beautiful game, and it kind of stands on its own as a piece of art and a piece of really thoughtful games making. But there's also crazy stuff there as well. A British developer has taken over a game called Quick Draw. This is a studio called Greenfly Studios, which is just two people, and it's this brilliant physical game which uses the PlayStation Move controller, which is a kind of a digital wand which allows you to control games through sort of wafting this thing around. But it's basically a simulator of those kind of high noon duel moments in cowboy films, and you stand in you stand in your living room or in a pub, anywhere where you can run this game against another player, and you both take 10 steps away from each other and turn around, and you have to point your controller at the other one quicker. And it's so funny and so inclusive and such an audience participation event. And it, again, it's like nothing else you'll see on that show floor. And, whenever I go to E3, that is, IndieCade is kind of my treat for myself. I put away 2 hours and I go there and I meet these people and see these games, and they say so much more to me about the potential of games for a much wider population.
Fantastic. They sound amazing. We'll look forward to reading more about those. Keith, tell us how we are covering E3, because you have organised a really interesting sister event.
I have, yeah. Yeah, well, I discovered late on that I wouldn't be able to go to E3 this year. So instead of sitting at home sensibly covering the whole thing from my bedroom, I decided, well, if I can't go to E3, I'll kind of bring E3 to London. So I got together with a games developer, George Backer, and we have created our own event called E2 London, and it's in a little bar in Soho called The Loading Bar, which is dedicated to games. It's very much a games meeting place, a games hangout. And we've invited a bunch of indie games developers. We've invited lots of journalists to come along. And it's really, we're just going to set games developers out on the tables with their tablets, with their laptops, and they're going to show people all their latest stuff. And in the evening, we've got this incredibly ambitious plan to live stream a kind of, almost like a breakfast TV show covering E3. We'll be running trailers and interviewing developers and that sort of thing. And we were so lucky. Sony got on board, and so did PlayJam, who are making the new GameStick console. And they've helped us with costs because the whole thing was becoming more and more expensive. But, yeah, it's essentially a kind of indie side show to E3. And anyone can come along as well. Although we've sold tickets, if you're in London, if you're in Soho, you can come along. And if we can fit you in, if we can squeeze you in, then you'll be welcome to come along and see these amazing, very different games. But yeah, I think the good thing is E3 is such a mammoth show, but it also creates a window in the year where we can all kind of think about and get really excited about games and about what games do and where games can go. So even though E3 itself is very mainstream, ours is not the only satellite event that's kind of spun out from it. There are others around, and it just creates a kind of focal point for us to think about the potential of games.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us, Keith. That was a really good insight into what will be happening at E3 this year, which kicks off on June the 11th. You can read more about that at guardian.co.uk/tech. And now for a tech news roundup with Jason Phipps.
This week, Samsung won a surprise victory in a patent battle with Apple that could see the iPhone 4 and 3G-capable iPad 2 banned from sale in the US. The decision over a patent deemed essential to conform with the 3G standards, which Samsung has pledged to license freely, will be appealed against by Apple, which said that it will have, quote, no impact on the availability of its products in the US. The final judgment by the International Trade Commission, which only adjudicates on requests for import bans to the US, will intensify debate over the US patent system, which is seen as hobbling competition in some fields. It came just hours after President Barack Obama pledged to shake up his country's patent litigation system with reform of the ITC among its objectives. Samsung said, "We believe the ITC's final determination has confirmed Apple's history of free riding on Samsung's technological innovations." Apple said it was, quote, disappointed with the decision and that it would appeal to a federal court. The only other alternative to avoid the import ban would be to appeal directly to President Obama. As the riots continue in Turkey, this week The Guardian reported that many in that country are getting around suspected censorship by their government by downloading software that encrypts and hides their connections to the outside world. Also, many Turks are downloading communication apps such as Twitter and Ustream and Zello, which works like a walkie-talkie, so that they can record events and avoid surveillance. Over the last few days, more than 120,000 people inside Turkey have downloaded Hotspot Shield, a free mobile app that provides a virtual private network, a VPN connection that cannot be tapped, and can link to the outside world, avoiding censorship. Anchor Free, which makes the software, said its product, already popular inside the country as a means of evading government internet censorship, had leapt in numbers more than 3,000-fold over the last few days. The Turkish government has been repeatedly criticised by pressure groups inside the country country who say it has been blocking or censoring Twitter and Facebook content for months leading up to the latest protests. Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan recently called Twitter, quote, a menace, adding, the best examples of lies can be found there. To me, social media is the worst menace to society, he said. Zynga, the social gaming company behind Cityville, Words with Friends, and Draw Something, announced this week that it is laying off 580 people and closing offices in New York, Dallas, and Los Angeles. The gaming firm's shares have fallen 64% since it went public at the end of December 2011, as investors have worried about its ability to make money from mobile game players. The company said its cuts represent 18% of its workforce and will save it $80 million a year. Zynga grew rapidly as its games took over on Facebook and now has over 240 million active users a month. But like the social network giant, the gaming company has found it harder to make money as its players migrated to mobile. The company said it expected to make a net loss upward of $39 million in the second quarter of 2013, and the restructuring will cost the company upwards to $26 million. And finally this week, in the US state of New Mexico, in the town of Alamogordo, it was agreed to allow a Canadian multimedia company, Fuel Industries, to search the town's old landfill site, where old Atari games are rumoured to be buried. One of the most sought-after games by the company is the E.T. video game. It is thought by some to be among the worst video games of all time. It's believed that 9 articulated lorries full of E.T. games and other Atari toys delivered their shipments to the landfill in 1983. Atari paid film director Steven Spielberg tens of millions of dollars to license the name of the wildly popular 1982 movie. Alamogordo town official Jason Baldwin said he played the E.T. game and it was, quote, horrible. Fuel Industries has been given 6 months to search the landfill site. Nice work if you can get it. For all these stories and so much more, just go to the best site on the web for tech, digital and gaming news. That's guardian.co.uk/tech.
We're joined today by Rytis Witkauskas, who is co-founder of Yplan. It's quite a successful London-based app that helps you decide where you're going to go out to tonight. Thank you for joining us, Rytis.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for the time.
Now, digging back into your history, your first business was at the age of 14. Do you think entrepreneurialism is something that's in your blood?
Most certainly. As luck would have had it, while I was growing up in Lithuania, which is where I'm from originally, I started to become very interested in computers at a very early age. And as it happened, by the age of 14, I was so into computers that I decided to start a computer business. So we started assembling, fixing, and upgrading personal computers, essentially for people who didn't have one but wanted one. And that's what I did as a teenager from the age of 14 to the age of 19, that's right.
What do you think that experience contributed to your style, to what you know about running a business now?
Sure. So very early on, I kind of took a real liking in taking full responsibility for a project or for a business and running with it from A to a successful conclusion, which ultimately is an up and running and successful business enterprise. So having that experience early on in my career, if you will, has been very helpful and also helped me shape the way I think about things like forming an excellent team, complementing my own skill set with other skills that are required in the business, and all of that fell into the right places as we were starting Yplan a good half a year ago.
Later, after business school, you worked for an investment company, and before you started Yplan, and that also must have given you that's a less common journey for entrepreneurs, certainly from the people that we interview on the pod. So again, what did that how did that inform how you run your company?
Yeah, certainly. So after graduating from high school in Lithuania, I studied in Germany where I met my co-founder. Vic, Yplan's co-founder, and then did my MBA in the U.S. at HBS. And then thereon, I spent over 3 years at Summit Partners, which is a growth equity and venture capital fund. And as a vice president there, I had a really rare and unique opportunity to work with hundreds of entrepreneurs and CEOs, and every single day was able to learn about the different business models, different ways to build a successful business, and also learn about scaling, how to build, you know, a business from an idea into a successful business into a globally dominant business. And that truly it was a unique experience that then helped me formulate a lot of the thesis around how Y-Plan needs to ultimately operate, and kind of gave the strong background that we then put to work as we were starting Y-Plan.
Entertainment and where to go to entertain yourself, frankly, that's quite a popular area, and lots of people have tried to crack this nut over the years. Why is Y-Plan better than the competition?
Y-Plan is a very unique proposition in the way that it's razor focused on one particular use case. You want to do something cool right now. And Y-Plan is not about, you know, ticketing as such. Y-Plan is a discovery app that also allows you to complete a booking in just two clicks once you've discovered a cool concert or a cool theater performance or a rooftop cinema or a chess boxing event that you just saw on the app. So the beauty of Y-Plan's model is that we complete the circle, if you will. You as a consumer, you discover the event, you can book in two clicks on your smartphone, and you can show up at the event with just your phone. Meanwhile, you're not paying extra fees, and you don't need to call anybody to confirm your booking or to print any of your tickets. It's that simple. You fire up the app, discover the event, two clicks, you've booked, and you're going.
How do you present that discovery experience, though? Because when you have a huge amount of events and different kinds of events as well, it's very important to present the relevant kind of experience to users. So how do you slice and dice those experiences?
Absolutely. You've hit it right on the head. The consumer these days feels oftentimes that there is such an overwhelming amount of information available about what's going on. And oftentimes people just get lost in all that choice. So what Y-Plan does is we have a dedicated team of curators who pick and choose the best and most interesting events happening in London today. And then we're expanding now Y-Plan into other cities as well. But they pick and choose the best events and then they make them infinitely easy to book those events on the app with just two clicks. So the curation element is very important. And that saves our customers the work of actually, you know, figuring out what's cool and hot happening today, but also the events that that still have a few tickets available. Oftentimes, Y-Plan will also get exclusive access to sold-out events, so events that are impossible to get into any other way. And this way, we allow our community to experience some of the coolest events, some of the coolest sold-out events happening in their city, which obviously consumers, or our customers, I should say, reward us with a lot of love.
What does the experience look like for consumers, though? I know that you present this carefully curated list, as you call it, for 15 events every night.
Exactly.
So it can't be completely personalized around every single person, can it?
It can over time, and this is very much the direction we're heading towards. So curation is one element in our model. So our team curates the events, and then we invest heavily into data science and making sure that over time, that as you use the Y-Plan app, it becomes a better and better concierge for you, depending on your particular tastes, on the events that you wanted before, on the events that you clicked on before, also on your social media profiles, et cetera, et cetera. So that combination of curation and data science is a very powerful mix. And then for you as a user, as Y-Plan's customer, the experience is very straightforward. You just fire up the application. Straight away, it takes you to a short list of events happening today. All of them are presented in a nice and very visual format, and you can literally go to every single one of those events with two clicks. So if we don't have tickets available for a particular event, you won't even see it on the app.
You're really competing against people's friends, though, their social networks, the word of mouth of somebody just phoning up and saying, what do you want to do tonight? And how do you really meaningfully represent that kind of social connection between people without encouraging people just to be buried in their phones all night when they're supposed to be out socializing?
Through the Y-Plan app, you can easily share the events that you like with your friends, be it via via email, via text messaging, Twitter, Facebook, or you can just book a bunch of tickets and then grab your friends right afterwards. So it incorporates very well the social element of going out, because rarely do people go out solo, right? Everybody wants to grab at least, you know, a buddy or a boyfriend or a girlfriend, a wife or a husband, and we facilitate that through the app. And in the future, in our product roadmap, we have even more social features weaved into the Wipe Line app.
So you're not going to encourage people to be buried in their phones all night when they should be talking to each other?
We encourage people to be spontaneous. And frankly, the key competitor to Wipe Line is a customer sitting at home and watching telly, or going around the corner to the same pub or the same restaurant where he or she has always been going to for the last many, many years. So this is really our main competitor. And we say, hey, actually, your city has so much more to offer, and every event is now only two clicks away from you. Grab your friends and go do something different, do something new.
How do you make money from this? Because we know that you've just had a very meaty round of Series A financing. So what does your balance sheet look like? How do you make money, and what's impressed your investors?
Yeah, so Wipeline is a straightforward proposition. You as a consumer or a customer of Wipeline, you pay what you see. So there is no trickery, there is no hidden fees, there is only one price point which you see from the very beginning, and that is ultimately the price that you end up paying for the tickets. And oftentimes it is just the normal value, the face value of the event. Sometimes it also has a nice little discount thrown into the mix as well, or an additional Wipeline perk, such as you know, a free glass of wine or free popcorn if you go to an art house cinema, you know, theater close by. So, and the way that Wipeline operates as a business is that we generate revenue from every transaction that is transacted through Wipeline, and we work directly with event organizers, so promoters, producers, and venues that host the events to get our commission from every sale that flows through the app.
You're about to tell me that you're going to be expanding to the US. Am I right?
That is correct. So Wipeline has been working extremely well in the city of London. So we launched just over 6 months ago in late November of 2012. And in that short amount of time, Wipeline has grown into a large and successful mobile commerce business here in London, landing on about 10% of all iPhones that exist in the city of London. So to be precise, we have over 200,000 active customers now on Wipeline. And that really lends itself well now for us to focus on expanding the business. So the next stop for us will be several cities in the U.S., so just across the pond, starting with New York, the launch of which is planned for the second half of this year.
When you say you're on 10% of phones, does that mean that 10% of iPhone users in London have downloaded the app?
Exactly.
Or does that mean that 10% of iPhone users in London are actually regularly using your app at least once a month?
Yeah, so exactly. So those are active customers. So those are people who are active in the app. And the 200,000 number is a portion of the 1.8 million iPhones that exist in the city of London. And in the nearest future, we will also delight the users of Android phones as well. We'll be launching an Android application for Wipeline sometime in late this summer. Hopefully,
is that because you're new and shiny? And how do you sustain that kind of interest in what you're doing?
Sure. So new and shiny is obviously a good thing. And what it boils down to ultimately is the product itself. How do people feel about using the product, especially on the mobile phone? And Wipeline is a very straightforward, very neat application that people tend to fall in love with. And then they express that love by telling about Wipeline to their friends, by sharing about it on Twitter, and then sharing about Wipeline on Facebook. And that really is sustaining a lot of our growth. By far, the majority of our users came on board through word of mouth, online and offline. So friends just telling friends. And then ultimately, the product is important, but then the events themselves are equally important. So what we try to do is to make sure that every time you fire up the Wipeline application, there is at least a few events that will capture your fancy. And there may be more known events. For example, just this last weekend, we had the the large Beyoncé event in Twickenham Stadium, which was hugely successful for Wipeline. We filled close to 1% of all of the seats in the Twickenham Stadium. And then this week we'll have, you know, a few other phenomenal events that are just different and cool. For example, chess boxing or hot tub cinema. So every time you fire up Wipeline, our hope and intention is that you will find something that is exciting, either exciting because you have heard and you're a fan of a particular band or a particular performance, or because it's an event that you never even would have thought of going to anyway, and now you're seeing it, and it's only two clicks away from you. So that's why people and our customers are excited and keep coming back and back and back and back to the app, which is again one of the things that really excited the new investors that are supporting now our growth and expansion.
Well, it's encouraging to hear that there is still a place for editorial curation, and maybe there's a space in there for an opportunity to bring in more kind of celebrity people to curate your nights out. But we will keep watching what you're doing. Congratulations on the funding, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
For more information and a look at Wipeline's stylish interface, you can go to their website at wiplanapp.com. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, for breaking tech news day and night, go to guardian.co.uk/tech. But from me, Jemima Kish, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.